translation. Thus traveling, I felt tired, both bodily and mentally, and I was both thirsty and hungry. So I took a bath in a river lake and also drank water. By contacting water, I got relief from my exhaustion. Srila Prabhupada's purport. A traveling mendicant can meet the needs of the body, namely thirst and hunger, by the gifts of nature without being a beggar at the door of the householders. The mendicant, therefore, does not go to the house of a householder to beg, but to enlighten him spiritually. Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasate Deve Gaudavani Pacharine Nirvishesha Sunyavari Paschachade Satarine Om Gyanam Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Shaksuru Militam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bheva Chaktitanam Bhavaniryo Vaishnaviryo Namo Namaha. So this is Narada Muni speaking to Vyasadeva, basically telling him the story of how he became a devotee. And so he's narrated, he's spoken of how he was the son of a maidservant. That means, son of a maidservant means not a high birth. Maidservant means Shudra. And so this maidservant cleans house and stuff like that. And she had a son. There's no mention of a father. Single mother from somebody, and so she was engaged by some sages. It was the rainy season, and especially Chaturmasya, the special vows of Chaturmasya are there, because in the rainy season in India you can't travel. These are traveling sages. Here in this verse, Prabhupada uses the word mendicant. He says in the previous verse, mendicant parivrajakacharya, one who wanders about. Of course, mendicant means a kind of beggar in English, because they live by begging. It's a mendicant. They're poor, they have no money, they have no wealth, so they live on alms. It's a style for saintly people. So these sages were spending time during the rainy season in the cave, and so they somehow engaged Narada Muni's mother to clean up and do some wash, whatever, like that. And then Narada Muni tells, he would hear them talking Srimad Bhagavatam, and listened to them, and heard from them, although he was just a boy. And then one time he took the remnants of whatever simple food they were eating, and therefore he got also purified spiritually. When translating this, Prabhupada, you may remember, calls these sages the Bhaktivedantas. He uses that name for them. They were hearing and chanting about Krishna, reciting Srimad Bhagavatam, and the boy heard it eagerly, and he said he was not lazy, and he helped serve them alongside his mother, and they spoke to him. Then his mother, shortly thereafter, died from the bite of a snake. And so he was orphaned completely. And so then he tells how he starts to, he says, I took it as Krishna's mercy. And then he describes how he, I'll go back, he left. He said he started for the north. North meaning where the Himalaya mountains are, the sages go. Because a sage, here's his journey. After my departure, after he left for the north, I passed through many flourishing metropolises, towns, big cities actually, metropolis means city, towns, villages, animal farms, mines, agricultural lands, valleys, flower gardens, nursery gardens, and natural forests. You see, there's a progression. First, there are the cities, and then there's the towns, and then there are villages, so it's getting more and more, fewer and fewer people. Animal farms, now you're down to where the people are herding cows and things. Then in remote places, mines, agricultural lands, growing things, valleys, flower gardens, nursery gardens, and some people are growing some fruit out there, and then finally natural forests. So getting lonelier. Fewer and fewer people. I passed through hills and mountains. Now, when you get to the hills and mountains, even fewer people are there. Full of reservoirs of various minerals like gold and silver and copper. Because these things would come from mountains usually. And through tracts of land with reservoirs of water filled with beautiful lotus flowers fit for the denizens of heaven, decorated with bewildered bees and singing birds. So there's no mention of people anymore. It's the forest, the jungle, the wilderness. I then passed along many forests of rushes, bamboo, reeds, sharp grasses, weeds, and caves. So it's getting a little rougher now. Before it was almost like natural parks, but now it's real thick jungle, which are very difficult to go through alone. I visited deep, dark, and dangerously fearful forests where no one goes, which were the play yards of snakes, owls, and jackals. A strange sound, woo, woo, woos, and things, you know, it's dangerous. So now we come to today's verse. Huh? So thus traveling, I felt tired, both bodily and mentally. The word is indriya. Prabhupada translates as bodily. Indriya means the senses. But when we say the sense of the word indriya, we use the English word sense. But there's 10 different kinds of senses that are mentioned. Two groups of five. The gyanindriya, the instruments for acquiring knowledge, that is to say, our sense of hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling. These are called the gyanindriya, the instruments of knowledge. But then there's the karmindriya, the instruments of action. This is the arms, the legs, the tongue. Also, tongue is both. Tongue for tasting and tongue for speaking. So it's double duty in both categories. And then the instruments for reproduction and for eliminating waste. So there you have that. And so when you say a body, it's just basically an organized arrangement of these 10 instruments. That's a body. For example, these are karo, the instruments of manipulation. The hands. So we have like this, but we could have claws, or we could have, you know, some other means of holding things. The legs, instruments of moving, locomotion. But we have two, but others have four. They're different, but that's what the body is. There's different arrangements for this. So he was tired in the senses. All his karmindriya, gyanindriya were exhausted. And atma here, atma means mentally. The word atma, of course, technically is the self. Also, it can mean the body and it can mean the mind. And so you have to be a little conscious of this. For example, just in English, I know I'm not the body, but still, if I stub my toe, I'll say I hurt myself. It's just the way the languages work. So here, when he was tired, indriya atma, in body and mind. He was just wiped out. And triparita, thirsty, bubukshitaha, and hungry. But he felt better when where the river makes a pool. He took a bath, snatva, he took a bath and drank water, and thus, with that contact, he got relief from his exhaustion. So he's describing here this situation feels better. And so Prabhupada says here in the purport, a traveling mendicant can meet the needs of the body, hunger and thirst, by the gifts of nature. They're already there by nature, without being a beggar at the door of the householders. So, because the mendicant is one who lives that way, by begging. And he's allowed to go to the householders, it mentioned earlier in the Bhagavatam, maybe later, at the time of the milking of a cow, and get a little milk. So it's supposed to be a renounced life. It's not that you find out who's got the good food, who doesn't, and you make sure you go to their house and so on. You're supposed to be renounced. But even more renounced is simply to take what's available. So this statement of Prabhupada, you should actually... the real purpose of going to the householders in the village, in the villages or town, which of course he's left them far behind already. He's gone into the wilderness. For in India, the wilderness is the jungle or the mountains. Vana. Vana usually translates forest, but it means anywhere where there's no cultivated land, wild land. Even a desert could be a vana. And you know, there's in the west, further west, the early Christians, mendicants, they would go into the desert. They're called the desert fathers. Sometimes would live on a pillar. And in the desert, some ruined temple or something, they would stay up on the Simon Stylites. He would sit on a pillar, and people would pass food up onto him on a stick or something like that, and so on. So, in the second canto, second chapter, let me just get this up here. This is also described, this style of life, where it's being recommended that one should not seek for unnecessary material things. And they're making the case here that Well, here what Prabhupada says, the text says, the Vedic sounds, that is to say, the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, describing the superior sense gratification of the heavenly planets, bewilders people. And they want to go there. But actually it says, in these places, they do not enjoy any real happiness. Another place, material happiness, is called Maya Sukha, illusory pleasure. And Prabhupada says, the conditioned soul is always engaged in laying out plans for happiness in the material world. And that's what everybody's doing. Even up to the end of the universal limit, even in the heavenly planets, he is not even satisfied with the available amenities on this planet Earth, where he has exploited the resources of nature to the best of his abilities. He wants to go to the moon and the planet Venus to exploit the resources there. Of course, you notice there's not much space exploration anymore, because when America started going into space, President Kennedy called it the new frontier. But in America, frontier has a special meaning, because the Europeans were then on the East Coast, and then the border between this and the rest of the territory was called the frontier. You know, in the cowboy movies, they're all on the frontier. Here is settled land, and out there is forests and fields, and of course a few Indians, which you have to get out of the way one way or another. And then at that frontier, that's the place that you can become rich. There's land available, there's wild animals, there's and by exploiting the frontier, money comes. You get the resources. First, people were going out and trapping animals, and they were getting the furs of beaver and other things and sending them back to Europe and becoming rich. And so whatever you can do to get raw materials and make money, that's the frontier. So when they're talking about space is the new frontier, we can get rich. And when they couldn't, when it was so expensive, and they couldn't find anything worthwhile, they stopped. Now they're again talking about maybe some way we can, if we could, on some asteroid, you know, the little planets in the that are smaller than planets, maybe some of them are made of gold or valuable minerals, and we can somehow send robots to mine them and send them back to Earth. Somehow we can exploit this. They're still trying to figure it out. Anyway, so they're going. But the Lord has warned us in the Bhagavad Gita about the worthlessness of all the innumerable planets of the universe, as well as the planets within other systems. He says, from the highest planet down to the lowest, they're all places of misery. They're dukkalayam, ashasvatam, temporary and misery. There are innumerable universes and also innumerable planets in each of them, but none of them is immune to the chief miseries of material existence, namely the pangs of birth, the pangs of death, the pangs of old age, and the pangs of disease. The Lord says that even the topmost planet, known as Brahmaloka or Satyaloka, and what to speak of other planets like the heavenly planets, it is not a happy land for residential purposes. Due to the presence of material pangs. And so he goes on, conditioned souls under the laws of fruitive activities. They go up to Brahmaloka and again come down to Patala Loka as if they were unintelligent children on a merry-go-round. You know, they play around and around with children. The real happiness is in the kingdom of God, where no one has to undergo the pangs of material existence. Therefore, the Vedic way of fruitive activities for the living entities are misleading. One thinks of a superior way of life in this country or that, and on this planet or another, but nowhere in the material world can he feel his real desire of life, namely eternal life, full of intelligence and complete bliss. So this is our take on the material world. Prabhupada says, Krishna who made it has certified it, dukkhalayam ashasvatam, full of miseries and temporary. This is what he said here. So then the Bhagavatam goes on, for this reason the enlightened person should endeavor only for the minimum necessities of life while in the world of names. Now there is a message that is going to destroy the economy. Because if we do not buy, everything collapses. The consumer economy. And therefore, we are in the business of increasing demands, making more and more unnecessary things. So we'll have to get it. Actually, you know, we are perfectly capable with present technology of, say, making an automobile that'll run without breaking down for 100 years. It could be done if you wanted to do it. But who wants to make an automobile like that? They want to make an automobile that you have to change. Even if it lasts for 5 years, after 2 years, it's old-fashioned. Everybody has newer ones, different shape and everything, and so you have to buy a new one, unnecessarily. But they can make it to last a long time. So they want to increase necessities of life. So here's just the opposite. Minimum, we should strive for less. Minimum necessities. He should be intelligently fixed, the enlightened person. The kavi means wise. The enlightened person should be intelligently fixed and never endeavor for unwanted things, being competent to perceive practically that all such endeavors, all such efforts, are merely hard labor for nothing. Hard work and nothing more. Shrama eva hi kevalam, says. The Bhagavatam, when there is ample earthly flats to lie on, what is the necessity of cots and beds? The earth is flat, you got a place to sleep, why bother with beds? Just lie down. Find an even place, take rest. What's the problem? When you have two arms, why do you need pillows? When you sleep, just put your head like this. What's the use? What's the need for pillows? You have the palms of your hands. Why do you need a plate? Your hand has fingers. What do you need? Knife, fork, spoon? People get married, you know, they have to go to the store. They have to, this is the kind of plates I want. I have to buy all the plates. You have to buy, this is my silver that I want. You have to buy this, buy that. You got it. It's right here, you know. That's all you need. And it gets dirty. Yeah, you wash your hands afterwards, you know. Simple enough. But for the plates, you have to have a sink, dishwashing machine, you know. All these machines, Prabhupada said, In the West, you have a machine for everything. He says, shocked, this is in the 60s, he says, late 60s, he said, there is even a machine for shaving. He said, astonished to see it. A machine for everything, even a machine for shaving. When there is, as far as dress, there's the tree bark. It's growing there. Or there's just the air. The directions, disha, you could say, the Naga Babas, you can go naked. A little bit of covering, you know. Why clothes? This is the text, huh? And then he says, are there no torn clothes lying on the road? You go on the road and you'll find discarded cloth there, you know, old used clothes, wash it. Wear it. Do the trees, which exist for maintaining others, no longer give alms and charity? Why go to anywhere? They're the trees, they got apples, whatever, oranges, bananas, you know. Pick it. They're already there. The rivers? Have the rivers dried up? Yeah, you're thirsty? There's water. They're still running, so there's water. Are the caves of the mountain now closed? You need to get out of the weather? There's a mountain cave. Use it. In other words, nature has provided the necessities are there. So long as you're trying to get the minimum, you'll find out that plenty is there. Are the caves of the mountains now closed? Or above all, does not the Almighty Lord protect the fully surrendered soul? If you've surrendered to Krishna, do you think that somehow he's not going to take care of you? He'll give you what you need. And then they say, why then do the learned sages go to flatter those who are intoxicated by hard-earned wealth? They go to the donors, the people that have money, and say nice things about them in order to get... You don't have to do this, huh? Prabhupada says... And so here he makes the same point. The renounced order of life is never meant for begging, or for living at the cost of others as a parasite, one organism that lives on another, a parasite, like the worm in your stomach, or whatever your intestines. According to the dictionary, a parasite is a sycophant, a flatterer, as they call a sycophant, who lives at the cost of society without making any contribution to that society. The renounced order is meant for contributing something substantial to society and not depending on the earnings of the householders. On the contrary, acceptance of alms for the householder by the bona fide mendicant is an opportunity afforded by the saint for the tangible benefit of the donors. That's what he's saying. The real reason that renounced people would go door to door for begging was actually to benefit the material people. Materialistic people, is for their benefit. Otherwise, if they're really renounced, they don't need it. There's plenty there. Of course, you know, we live in a different climate than India, and there's several seasons where it's very hard to live outdoors completely. This is the style. We should put our main effort into self-realization, and as far as sense gratification, how much sense gratification can one have? The answer is enough to be healthy. Because your body is an instrument for self-realization, so to keep the body healthy. That's the amount of sense gratification that I can have. And Prabhupada also pointed out in this regard that what's maybe a minimum for one person won't be minimum for another person, according to custom, habit, and so on. Householders are allowed more sense gratification than brahmacharis or sannyasis. Prabhupada makes this remark that one should, in the connection where the elephant and the crocodile, the fight between Gajendra and the crocodile, described, I think, in the 8th canto of Bhagavatam. So there, in the elephant is in the water when the crocodile seizes his leg and is pulling him in. And it says that in the water the crocodile was stronger than the elephant because that was his element. So there Prabhupada remarks that one has to, a devotee has to fight Maya. And he should fight Maya on favorable grounds, and what's favorable for one person won't be for another. Prabhupada had just had one of his leading sannyasis fall down and become a householder. And this was on Prabhupada's mind when he wrote this purport. And he said, even if you have to be a householder, you should still not give up the fight. You should still fight Maya. And he said then, what's favorable for one person won't be favorable to another. So the principle is, you should try to minimize the necessities of life. And what's different for one is what's minimum for one person may not be for another person. Well, for example, when Prabhupada had gotten the land in Mayapur and wanted his Western disciples to come. So he made a building that was now called the Lotus Building for his disciples to stay in. And when he made that building, he made indoor toilets. And for this, he was criticized by people around the Gaudiya Math. Indoor toilets. What a sense indulgence that is. Because in India, when it's time to answer nature's call, you take a little lota with water in it and you go out into the bush. And there you pass stool, squatting on the ground. Were there villages? Some place would be the designated place, you know, where people would go to pass through. And then actually, you know, the pigs would come later and eat it. So it was actually very, very ecologically good. The pigs would eat the stool. Oh, what was there in India, at least the sun would quickly dry it up. And so this was the system to go outside. And this idea of indoor toilets, because they're dirty, contaminated places, to have them indoors, especially where temples are, is not good. But Prabhupada answered his critics. He said, these are Western disciples. This is what they're used to. If they come here and it's too much austerity, they'll not be able to think of Krishna even. So he made these indoor toilets. And which I have to say, for me, they were very austere. I was used to a certain level of plumbing, you might say. First of all, there was no hot water whatsoever. There was some, you know, you could pass stool and so on, and you have to take a shower, you have to bathe afterwards. So, no, in India, you go in a lake or something. Here there were showers, but there was no hot water. There was no hot water. Yeah, we thought it was really austere, but the other people in India, oh, it's so. But the principle is to try to decrease, to try to minimize. So here, Prabhupada is making the same point here about the necessities of life. So here we find Narada Muni. He's gotten refreshed, and then in the next, he begins to meditate. Maybe I'll do this. It's a pretty short verse. He says in the next verse, 15, Tasmin nirman nuje ranye. People pasta ashataha atmanam atmanat mastam yatta shrutam chintayam. After that, under the shadow of a banyan tree in an uninhabited forest, I began to meditate upon the Supersoul situated within, using my intelligence as I had learned from liberated souls. So, Prabhupada says in the purport, one should not meditate according to one's personal whims, anyway, I think. Because he says, I meditated as I learned from, as I had heard from authorities. They taught me. He was taught how to meditate. And so, doing according to their instructions, he meditated. Prabhupada says, one should know perfectly well from the authoritative sources of scriptures through the transparent medium of a bona fide spiritual master and by proper use of one's trained intelligence for meditating on the Supersoul dwelling within every living being. This consciousness is firmly developed by a devotee who has rendered loving service unto the Lord by carrying out the orders of the spiritual master. Sri Naradaji contacted bona fide spiritual masters, served them sincerely, and got enlightenment rightly. Thus he began to meditate. So that's his meditate, according to instructions. It really helps in any endeavor to learn anything if you have a teacher. If you really want to learn how to play a musical instrument, like when, you know, all over the world there are kids sitting in their basement with a guitar trying to teach themselves guitar. But if you have a good teacher, it becomes much easier. They know. And it really helps to have somebody who's expert just to show you what's possible to be done. You might not, you know, when an expert plays a musical instrument, the first thing you think is, that's impossible to get that sound that way. They go, you try, you realize, oh, it's hard. They make it look easy because they're expert, but it's very hard. And so then they give you some discipline. And first you have to sit there and play the same thing over and over again. It's kind of boring. But you know, like when I was a child, my parents gave me lessons on the, not the guitar in those days, but the violin, Geiger, you know. So you have to go there. Da 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 da. Now, these exercises were designed by experts, and you do it, and you do it carefully, and then you go to your lesson once a week, and the teacher listens how you play. No, do it like this, do it like that, and you get good after a while. But you know that somebody's going to look and see how you're doing. You know, you try to improve, and gradually you get better. So this is spiritual life the same way. It's a discipline. It's not teach it yourself. and you want to become good. The standards are high for a spiritual life, and you need to be trained. So here, here are people who have progressed in spiritual life, who have gone through the stages, who know what the problems will be, who can see where there's difficulties and say, yeah, you should do this, you should be careful of this, watch this out. You can understand this way. So he had been taught by some experts, and so he says, as I had learned it from them, and of course, this is a little different from the pure bhakti yoga that we practice. We are following Lord Chaitanya. But there, in the early cantos of the Bhagavatam, the second canto, there are the people that are mixing bhakti with yoga. They're called yoga mishra bhaktas. That's what they practice. Because if you just do yoga, like the Patanjali yoga system, God is there. I mean, Patanjali recognizes the Lord, but the Lord is there to help you attain siddhis, perfections. And so that's your aim. So it's not exactly bhakti, Patanjali. Although he understands there is super soul. Now, of course, people are practicing yoga, they're complete atheists. But the original yoga, the Patanjali yoga system, first, one of the first requirements is Ishvara Pranidhan, worship of the Lord. But that's to help you, it's not that. So they only go so far, at best some super soul realization. Narada is doing yoga practice, but as a bhakta, for realizing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he's taught. He's under it's a banyan, but it's actually a pipala tree. The pipala tree is the tree that is worshipable. It's a worshipable, a sacred tree, pipala. It's a kind of a fig tree. Often nowadays it's called a banyan, but it's because the banyan is also a fig, but the banyan is the Bengali banyan tree. I think it's called Ficus indicus. But the pipala tree is called the Ficus religiosa. And it's the tree that Buddha is supposed to have sat under when he got enlightenment. They call it the Bo tree or Bodhi tree. It's a sacred tree, and therefore it's very good for sitting under when you are meditating. And so here Narada is under this pipala tree in the uninhabited forest. He's alone by himself and meditating on the super soul, using my intelligence, buddhi. There's another thing that people don't understand in the West, is idea of buddhi. Higher than the mind is buddhi. The mind accepts and rejects things according to sense gratification. Buddhi fixes the attention. Buddhi governs the direction of attention and concentration. And you'll find in the Bhagavad Gita, the term buddhi yoga is practically a synonym for bhakti yoga. It's directing the mind. So you see, we can be having our attention directed towards sense gratification, or we can have our attention directed towards self-realization. That direction of attention is buddhi. And in the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada describes the buddhi as the form in which the supersoul gives us direction. It's where the supersoul is connected to the individual living entity, embodied soul, by means of the buddhi. Because in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, from me comes memory, knowledge, and forgetfulness. I am situated in everyone's heart. From me comes Gyanam, Apohanam, mental things that come up, whether you think of Krishna, forget Krishna, remember Krishna, this is coming from the super soul. As Krishna, if we want to forget Krishna, then Krishna causes forgetfulness. If we want to remember him, he causes remembrance. Huh? And he's in the heart, and he governs in this way through the buddhi. And when he in the dhammi buddhi yogatam, I give them the buddhi by which they can come to me. He also says that I'm situated in the heart, and then with the light of knowledge, I illuminate them. So here he's using intelligence to focus his attention and increase the intensity of his concentration on the Lord. And that's what he does. And then next verse we'll find out what happens. Something interesting happens. Any questions? Yeah.
There is in the process of Bhakti Yoga, in the fourth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the four Kumaras, they are speaking to King Prithu about the eight processes for pure devotional service. Mm-hmm. And one of them is one of those eight processes is straightforward, being straightforward, dealing with people, with being straightforward. Myself, I have little difficulties to deal with this straightforward. I try to practice this straightforwardness in my spiritual life with me and with others also, and I see sometimes there is some difficulty to understand how to be straightforward and between devotees or with people. Can you explain a bit, elaborate how we can use this issue or this process?
Let me look this up and see what the Sanskrit word that is. There's several words that sometimes gets translated as straightforward. Well, it shows up a lot. And you say it's in the...
It's a discussion between the four Kumaras and King Prithu.
In which canto, you said?
Fourth canto.
Straightforward doesn't show up in the thing in there. What chapter? Do you remember which chapter it is? Let me look at the context. Fourth canto, Kumaras and Prithu, when they come to see him. Anyway, the idea of one quality of a brahmana is arjavam. That means straight, not crooked. So being straightforward usually just means being honest. Sometimes also Prabhupada calls it simplicity with oneself. Not absence of duplicity is simplicity. Frankness, mostly about oneself. I should, whatever faults I have, these are my faults. I don't try to hide them from me or to disguise them from others even. So when we speak of straightforward dealings with others, just being honest and not duplicitous, right? Now, another sense of straightforward is maybe having to say something to somebody that's truthful, but also a little painful for them to hear. But straightforwardness is not necessarily being rude or tactless. If we have something to say to somebody, if I have to, maybe it's my duty as an authority or an older person to tell somebody they're doing something wrong or making a mistake. Ideally, I should be able to do this in such a way that it doesn't cause offense. This is a trick. Sometimes. Because in the early days of the movement, it was sometimes very hard to come to the temple because the devotees were so tactless and heavy. You know, they're just heavy with everybody. It was one of my early visits to the temple. It was after the Sunday feast, and I stepped outside, and we'd been chanting for a while. I was feeling pretty good, and there was this beautiful sunset. And I said, on a spontaneous, "Oh, what a beautiful sunset!" And there was this Brahmacharini from the temple, who was also standing by the door, and she says, "It is not beautiful. It's horrible. And if you think it's beautiful, you'll just have to take birth again to enjoy it." And, you know, so my first reaction was, I don't think I want to come here anymore. You know, to talk like that, you know. Then I thought about it. I took her point, you know. I understood, you know, that how she was right, but it was harsh, you know. It was like so harsh. I mean, you know, you could say something, "Oh yes, it is beautiful, but think of how much more beautiful is Krishna who made it," you know. Or the Bhagavatam says that the sunset and the dawn are Krishna's dress, you know. And so, you know, there's different ways. What I mean by, you could make the same point, but in a not so abrasive manner. So we should learn the art of trying to have straightforward dealings with others, but at the same time, as much as possible, you know, trying to be tactful, not, you know, just smash them like a hammer. So that's another sense of straightforward. But generally, Prabhupada just talks about it in terms of in terms of being honest, direct, not duplicitous, not tricky. You know, not like the cards or whatever. That's. But I have to look at it. You can find. Show me later that passage. I'll look at it. You know, see what it says. Anything else? Yeah.
From the practical point of view, this description of two trees not give fruit anymore, do the tree will not give water and so on. I find it quite difficult to find some useful food, for example, in Switzerland if I go to a forest. So how to...
Yes, yeah, so you have to adapt to your country. It's clearly... The trees that produce fruit are called pious trees, and the ones that don't produce fruits or flowers are called impious. And so we live in an impious time, also we live in further north. You know, it's like. The people that live in India, up in the mountains, where there aren't, where it's, you know, almost continuous winter, they're very austere. You practice yoga, you find out the practice, like Dhruva, he could live on air alone. First, he's a gradual reduction, Dhruva Maharaj, of necessities. To practically, he was living on air. I remember I was once staying at our temple in Boston, and not far from us there was a healer. There was the Hippocratic Institute, or Hippocrates Institute, this lady named Anne Wigmore, And she was an advocate of a purifying and healing process by which you would eventually live only on air. If your body became acclimatized, that's what you would live on. But at the time, they hadn't reached that stage yet. I imagine being in a modern city like Boston and trying to live on the air would probably be pretty risky. It wasn't very pure air, you know. You probably had to have really good air. But she had people that were like supposed to be living on nothing but water and the juice from grass, wheatgrass juice. You sprout wheat and you take the wheat sprouts and make juice and just drink this green juice and nothing more. That was very austere. When they would fall down, they would come to our Sunday feast. When they fall either further, they go to the ice cream shop, Baskin's or Robbins, and so on. But we would see them sometimes sneaking in to get some from relief. So you can try that kind of austerity, but it's really very, very difficult. And, you know, if you take prasadam, which is karmaless food, in the beginning, you know, we encourage everybody to take plenty of prasadam, but as we get a little more advanced, we can become regulated. It depends again on your nature. Prabhupada himself never cared very much for fasting. So you can be very advanced. Other people, it depends on your nature and what is there. We honor Krishna Prasadam, and we should take like that. So, yeah, as our spiritual life increases, our dependence upon material things decreases. We should see this. That's our advancement in Krishna consciousness. We take what we need to use in Krishna service, and other things we don't bother with. So yeah, we are not living in places now where you can live like these people. You go to Hawaii, the trees are there with all year round with fruits and things like that. Especially if you like coconuts a lot, you can live on them. This is Kali Yuga. Climates, Kali Yuga weather, and so it's hard. So we adapt to circumstance, and of course Prabhupada knew that. When Prabhupada came to America, he was in New York the first winter. He saw something coming out of the sky, and he thought somebody was on the roof throwing down lime, the chemical lime, you know. With a white powder line, it was snow. He'd never seen it before coming down. Maybe he's seen it on the mountains in the distance, but actually falling. And it was very difficult for him that first winter in New York because of just not used to that kind of cold. But they're colder places than New York too that people live in. But that's why, you know, a birth in like very, very cold places is not considered to be very pious, because then you, practically the only thing to eat is, animals in the wintertime. heart. But that's our situation. What can we do? Anything else? How did I meet Prabhupada? Oh, it was a gradual process in a way. First I saw him in 1965. I didn't know who he was. When Prabhupada first came to America, he landed in New York, and then he went to a town called Butler, Pennsylvania, which is in my state, the western part of Pennsylvania. And when he went there, he took a bus from New York to Philadelphia, where I live. And I, at that time, I was going to college in Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania. It was my beginning of my last year. And then he changed buses and went all the way west to western end of Pennsylvania, where the big city is Pittsburgh. And then from there, he went a little north to this little town of Butler. He was there because he had to have a sponsor to get into America. Somebody had to sponsor him. It was very hard to get a visa, much harder in those days. There were practically no Americans, I mean, no Indians in America when Prabhupada came, because there had been a law many years ago limiting the number of people from Asia who could come to America since the 20s or something. And it changed that year. But so you saw very few Indian people in America. Anyway, but there was somebody there, a son of a friend of his, who got him a sponsorship. So he went to their house. And he stayed there 3 weeks, a month, kind of finding out about America and this little town, giving some talks in some universities and some churches and things like that. And then he came back to New York by retracing his route back. But this time when he came to Philadelphia, he had an engagement. One of the professors in Butler had made an arrangement for Prabhupada to speak in the class of Professor Brown at my university, who was a famous Indologist. So Prabhupada went to that class. So I was there at the university. It was my last year. In fact, I got married between my junior and senior year to the same woman I'm married to now, by the way. One day, it was October, I think, and I was up in the library overlooking the campus. And I see in the path running in front of this old building, College Hall, I see what looks to me like an Indian monk just walking. And I couldn't take my eyes off of him. And I came back to my wife and I said, I saw this Indian monk. He was so clean. He was so looked like he didn't belong in the world, and I want to be just like him. So that was my. I didn't realize it was Prabhupada. He was far away. I couldn't see his face. I could just tell he was Indian somehow by his complexion, and he was wearing robes. And as I say, you rarely saw an Indian in America. What to speak of somebody wearing some kind of robes like that. And that was Prabhupada. Because later on I found out when his exact schedule, when he came to America, somebody made a whole month-to-month where he was, and I saw that month he stopped off. And I showed it to my wife. She says, yeah, that must have been that. By then we were well initiated. So it was like that. Then a little later on, maybe about a year later, I had gone out of the city for a while, up to Massachusetts in graduate school, came back for a friend's wedding, a friend of mine who had been a college friend of mine at University of Pennsylvania. And it was a wedding that you would later call a hippie wedding, although the word hippie wasn't around yet. But we were reading from the I Ching and the Tibetan Book of the Dead and so many things like that. And so after the ceremony in his living room, it wasn't in a church or anything like that. And but he had a minister, somebody, and the legal perform the marriage. So afterwards, we go into a room. And then we sample some herbs, do it. And then he said to me, "I want you to hear this record." And he put this record on the machine. We had a long playing record, and it was Prabhupada chanting Hare Krishna. Because this friend of mine had a friend who was in the university in New York, where devotees were preaching. And he became that, his friend became, the friend of my friend became a devotee, became Tejas. But he had sent this record down to his friend, and so now he's being played, and it was Prabhupada chanting. And so I chanted along with everybody else. It sounded like somebody was far away, you know, calling me. Then I went back to Philadelphia, to another university, because they were starting to teach religion as something they stole from the Germans, Religionswissenschaft, academic study of religion. And I studied philosophy and literature, and now I wanted to check out religion. So I was in a PhD program for religion in this university. And I signed up for a Hinduism course. And the teacher of that course was a Mayavadi sannyasi named Swami Nikhilananda. Swami Nikhilananda was the head of the Ramakrishna Mission in New York. And he was teaching us Hinduism, but basically it was Ramakrishna Mayavad philosophy. But when I first got there, my first class, one of the students said to me, they said, "Last semester, we had a bhakti yogi come and talk to us." That was Prabhupada. Because if you read the Prabhupada Lilamrita, they talk about this, but they called him the Uptown Swami. Prabhupada was downtown, the Lower East Side, where all the hippies and poor people were. That's where Prabhupada was. Uptown, where the rich people were, was the Ramakrishna Mission and Swami Nikhilananda, who dressed like a lawyer. You know, a three-piece suit, you know, with the little stripes, pinstripe suit. He even had a pocket watch, you know, like an elderly lawyer. That's how he dressed. And he had, Prabhupada Lilamrita, he had advised Prabhupada, "You should dress like this." Yeah. So I heard about this bhakti yogi. So then, 3 years later, I encounter devotees chanting, and I get a book, a little pamphlet called "Who is Crazy?" with a lecture of Prabhupada, and I barely understood it. I barely understood it, because I was such a Mayavadi by then. But I had read the Bhagavad Gita in my classes maybe three times, four different translations. In the last, all classes in Hinduism taught by Indians, and all teaching Mayavad philosophy is Hinduism. So with the last time I was reading Bhagavad Gita, I thought, it seemed to me that the Bhagavad Gita was saying to surrender to Krishna. Nobody ever told me that. In fact, I thought it was my original discovery. That's what the Bhagavad Gita is teaching. It was another translation, but not Prabhupada's. And I actually sat there thinking, well, I thought if the Bhagavad Gita is teaching surrender to Krishna, that's what I should do. And I closed my eyes and I went, surrender, surrender, surrender. And I opened my eyes, nothing happened. But then it was just a month later or so, I heard the devotees chanting Hare Krishna. The university was called Temple University on the temple campus, you know. So I got some book. And then the same guy whose wedding I was at earlier, he called me up and said, hey man, there's this far out love feast. You gotta come to this far out love feast, you know. So then I went to the temple. And without, like an anthropologist, you know, like a student of religion, I just want to examine these people. But after that first visit, I brought some beads home and started chanting. Yeah, because actually, the devotee, he would talk about straightforward. This guy gave a lecture. The lecture was about no illicit sex, no intoxication, no meat eating, no gambling. That was the lecture. Heavy. And you know, I'm sitting with all these people. They're like, the whole audience is like, they're students and they're other hippies and they smell like marijuana and patchouli oil, you know, and I'm sitting there. And they're looking for, some of them are looking for the door, you know, to get out, you know. But you know, I thought, wow, he's telling the truth. Because I had been studying religion, you know, for 3 years, and I was looking, what is the highest thing, you know, in all these religions? And I decided that when Buddha said, he said, life is suffering, we say material existence, I believed it completely. I knew that was true. He says, the cause of suffering are our desires, our cravings, our attachments. Yeah, that's for fact. I can understand that. We want something permanent and we're in a place where everything is temporary. How are we going to be satisfied? That I could understand. He said, then the third step is you have to extirpate. This is the word there, you extirpate, you know, remove these desires. So I made a few attempts in that way, but without any success whatsoever. But the devotee was talking about giving your senses spiritual engagement. You can't control these desires by trying to just get rid of your senses. You have to engage them. Now, after so many Hinduism courses, this was a brand new idea. Nobody had said that. It was that you could actually give your senses spiritual engagement. So I thought, let me try it. Let me try it. We were, for spiritual life, we were taking some very powerful chemicals in those days, you know, some wooden beads, and Hare Krishna, it sounds pretty harmless. So I got some beads, I went home, and I started chanting. And my material desires began to decrease. In fact, they decreased so fast, I got scared and stopped. You know, I wasn't quite sure what to do with myself, and this was something very powerful. Who were these weird people? You know, and so on. And maybe I didn't want them to go away so quickly. But then I felt horrible, so I started chanting again. And so the result was is that maybe a year later, in order to just associate with devotees, we moved into a temple. My wife, a three-year-old child, baby, 6-month-old baby, was crazy. But I stayed. And then I moved in January, and then in July, Prabhupada had all the time been out of the country. And he came back to New York, and I went up and got initiated at that time. And that's the first time I had visual. I'd read his books, I would listen to his lecture. We had a big reel-to-reel Grundig tape recorder. He had a few lectures on it. There was no cassettes yet. Listened to a lecture and heard about him from people, read his books. I mean, Isha Upanishad was the biggest revelation I'd studied the Isha Upanishad. And nobody knew what it meant. Even the translator said it was obscure. But Prabhupada, you know, laid it all out. And it was more than the Isha Upanishad, really. You know, at first, the devotees were so weird and strange and sometimes very difficult to be with. I mean, they made it hard in many ways. I was very attracted to the devotees, but they were harsh. Every time you did something, it was wrong. You know, you walk in the temple room and you walk into the temple and you look in the kitchen. Don't look in there! That's being offered to Krishna. You blow out a candle. Your mouth is the dirtiest part of your body. It's all on. It was up. I think we've improved a little, but maybe not every time, everywhere. But. But I was very attracted because, you know, their renunciation and their dedication. And I knew you had to do something like that if you were serious about spiritual life. I knew. And the Isha Upanishad, I wanted to be a devotee, but the Isha Upanishad made it intellectually possible for me. Because, I mean, I was in graduate school, by most people's idea, an intellectual. And my field of study was philosophy of religion and theology. As I hear, it was theology. And it was simple language, really simple language, straight, nothing with the big words or anything, but so profound. And after that, I was finished with any idea of being a Mayavadi. It just did the job. Yeah, and that's what Prabhupada brought, you know. And even the book, the first edition of the Isha Upanishad, it practically fell apart in your hands. You know, the binding was bad, the art was primitive. Whoever edited the thing didn't know that much about the editing English. It was like, now it's been cleaned up somewhat, but it was very, very crude book. But boy, it was so profound. Yeah. So that's when I saw Prabhupada the first time, is when I got initiated. There was lots of people being initiated. This was in New York. We had a rented building in Brooklyn on Henry Street. It had been a nursing home run by the Catholics. And we had gotten it. And Prabhupada came, and because Prabhupada was out of the country for a long time, people were waiting to get initiated. And it took a long time. If you want to sit here and listen, since we're not having breakfast today, I'll tell you the story. There were whole groups of devotees were coming. When Prabhupada did the initiation, because I was there with my wife and we had two children, they put us in the first group because they wanted to. The temple was packed with devotees. People were sleeping on the roof. They were sleeping outside on the fire escape. The halls, the closets, everywhere. You know, it was so packed with people. And so they wanted people from out of town to go away as soon as possible, especially those with children. And so my wife and I were initiated the first day. And there was about 12 or 15 people at each fire sacrifice. It took a long time because the first thing that we did was sit there while Prabhupada chanted on the beads for everyone in front of us, one after another. So it was time consuming. You know who was initiated the same fire sacrifice with me? Harikesh, who was then a brahmachari. Ramapada Swami, who was then a brahmachari, who was like, then it was really, really funny because when I was initiated, we'd go up to Prabhupada and he'd ask you the regular principles and he'd tell you your name. And he said to me, "Your name is Om Swarup." Om Swarup. That's the way I heard it, you know. And then he said, like sunshine, in the meaning of the name. So I offered obeisances and sat down. And I said to the guy next to me, did you hear what he said my name was? And he said, Govinda Swarup. That didn't sound right. I wasn't sure what my name was. Then my wife was initiated. And he said, Saldamini, he said, and he gave the meaning as brilliant night, like lightning illuminating at night. The goddess of fortune is like, her complexion is like that. So I thought that was very poetic. I'm sunshine and she's, I'm light of the day and she's light of night. But it's very poetic to pick those names like that. So then afterwards, I go up to the temple president, was Bhavananda, who had the list of names. I said, what is my name? Is it Govinda Swarup? He says, no, it's Ravindra Swarup. I said, oh, Ravindra Swarup. He says, yeah. And then somebody behind him said, someone else had that name before. I said, who was that? They said, oh, some crazy hippie. And then all day long people say, what is my name? And I tell them this. Oh yeah, someone else had that name before. And I say, who is it? They say, just a crazy hippie. So if you read Prabhupada Lilamrita, he was in the very first initiation. This guy named got the name Ravindra Swarup. And that was the one. So I'm not that guy before me. And then Prabhupada gets reused the name. So that's when I saw him visually on that first initiation. Again, I was quite struck by his appearance. It was startling to see how short he was. You know, because it was hard because all the American guys, like around him, was very tall, but it was the sense of being like very, it really was effulgent. I tried to figure out what is this effulgence? Because he's not giving off light like a light bulb, but it's the effect. If you have a kind of a spotlight and it shines a light on something, it looks brighter than everything else. It was like a light was on him, but it wasn't the light we could see. So he just looks like, and the effect of that is, whatever you're looking at is somehow clearer, more precise, better defined than everything else. That was the, I'm analyzing, how Prabhupada looks. And then the first time I saw somebody drink like that, it was really nice. So then, I was initiated in July, and by the end of the year, I was the temple president. Can you imagine? I had no idea what I was doing, but the guy who, the devotee who was the temple president, he there was some politics against him. He got disgusted. He quit, and they made me the temple president. Then immediately there was politics against me. same person, but this time I didn't leave. He did. So I was just didn't even have second initiation, So I was the oldest person there. I was like 24. Everybody else was like 18 and stuff like that, And I had a little experience. I had worked and that's how they taught us how to be devotees. Sometimes. The way you teach a dog to swim, you throw it in the water. sort of like that. So then I'd see Prabhupada. As a temple president, you had to write to him and had some correspondence. And he wanted me to do something different. When I came to the temple, it was I had finished my coursework for a PhD. I mean, 3 years of courses I'd finished. And the next thing would be to write a doctoral dissertation. And the devotees were telling me to quit. I should quit. They took out the Bhagavatam and they showed me where Prabhupada had written The modern educational institutions are the slaughterhouse of the young. And that I should quit. Well, okay, now I... But then I was wanting, you know, I mean, I had so much time and put into it, you know, maybe it's worth something. So I asked Nayana Baran, the temple president, why don't you write to Prabhupada and find out what I should do. So the answer came back that I should finish and get a PhD. When the devotees heard this, it didn't affect them. They said, no, you should quit anyway. He's just telling you that because you're attached. So I thought about that for a while, and I said, yeah, I'm probably attached, but still, you know, I want to make my mother happy and stuff like that, but still, if Prabhupada said to do it, I should do it. We didn't know that he had in mind things like Bhaktivedanta Institute and all these things, you know. So, but that was something we had got from the hippies, you know, you had to drop out. You had to completely drop out of society. And then of course, Prabhupada, when he would come to America, he would always stop in New York. So it takes 2 hours to drive from Philadelphia to New York with the traffic. And so it was easy to, whenever he came, we'd go up and see him. And then also, we didn't come to New Vrindavan sometimes. That was longer, but it was 6 hours drive to get to New Vrindavan. He came there for Janmashtami once, before we had Mayapur and anything. He came to New Vrindavan for Janmashtami. We were all sleeping out in tents and things like that. And then finally he came to Philadelphia in 1975. We started a Rath Yatra. I'm also a Jagannath Bhakta there in Philadelphia, because we ended up very early on with big Jagannath deities. They came of their own accord, as sometimes Jagannath wants to do. When Nayana Baran was still the temple president, I went up to New York temple to get some BTG magazines. I had a car. I had a Volkswagen Beetle, which the devotees actually quickly destroyed, but because I didn't want to use it. And there was somebody that didn't believe in second gear, you know, who was driving it. I took my wife and children up to New York to get some BTGs, and then I got there at the same temple. They said, this is before I was initiated. Yeah, this is before then. They said, did you see Philadelphia's Jagannath deities? They made Jagannath deities for New York, but then found out that the big Radhakrishna deities were coming, and the deities were too big, so they wanted to sell them to Philadelphia. And there I saw these, you know, big, beautiful Jagannath deities. Rukmini was a pujari, and she uncovered them. Oh, wow, look. So I took them back to Philadelphia. In fact, I had to send my wife and children home on the train. And the Volkswagen, you could put the back seat down flat. So I put the DVDs in the back seat and met them. And then I tried to get Nayana Baran to... I said, look, we have the DVDs. I had them set up when the devotees came back from Sankirtan. They were there. They said, we need three brahmanas to worship the DVDs. There's only two. We can't. So they went in the closet. But then that summer... we had a Rath Yatra that took little Jagannaths out of somewhere and took them on a little palanquin and took them out to a park and chanted. Nayana Baran wrote to Prabhupada about it and said we had a Rath Yatra. And Prabhupada said, next year, you should have a Rath Yatra with a cart with wheels, even if it's small. So next year I was president, and we had these big Jagannath Vedis in the closet. So I said, well, let's make a cart and take out the big Jagannath Vedis. You know, we'll have a little parade. And I found out I could have a parade in the city, and I got the permits and everything, and some devotees are very good. They made a cart. And so then I advertised. And meanwhile, you know, the only other Rath Yatra at that time was out of San Francisco, I think. Yeah. Maybe Chicago, I don't know. But so there's no Rath Yatras in the East Coast of the United States. And I didn't know what ISKCON was like, but I just advertised, you know, wrote something up and duplicated it and mailed it out to the devotees that were going to have this Rath Yatra parade. And they came. Huge numbers of devotees and Vishnu Janan and, you know, all these like, big kirtan guys and sannyasis and kirtan and Ananda, they're all there. They came to Philadelphia for, I didn't realize that, you know, this movement, everybody likes a party. I didn't know who was going to come. And we had newspaper reporters and everything come. And then Rupa Nuba, who was my GBC, he finally shows up. And somebody said, he's here, he wants to talk to you. I went up to the room. The whole temple room is packed with people. We're chanting, having a big kirtan. The reporters are taking notes and interviewing people. And Rupa Nuba says to me, you can't take those deities out of the closet. Put them on the cart and put them back in the closet again. Because I thought by then the only brahmanas were myself and my wife. We had gotten second initiation at the beginning of the year. So we couldn't, you know, worship the deities yet. We only had two brahmanas. But there's a Panchatattva painting on the altar. He said, you can't do that. Take them out and put them back in the closet. And I thought, my God, he's going to cancel the Rath Yatra. What'll I do? All these people here. But then he said, so I've brought another brahmana. This is Parichrikanandadas Brahmachari. He's going to stay here. Now you have three brahmanas. So install them. And I said, how do you do that? And he said, you take them down. You get some kind of a pail or bucket and you bathe them. And then put them on the altar. Chant. And put them on the altar. Chant. You bathe them and chant and circumambulate them and then put them on the altar. I said, okay. And I went running down the street where there was some hardware store or something, and they had these plastic buckets, basins that you bathe babies in, you know, a little like this big. So I got one and I put it down and took the deities out of the closet. And put each one in the basin, and then we poured water on them. Everybody poured water, and we chanted. We looked at Lord Balaram, who, of course, is white, and that being in the closet, somehow or other, he had some little, little dirt on him. And so she got some soap, and we were taking a bath, you know. And then we made one outfit only. You would call it a slip or a night outfit, you know, where we dab it in salt. And then somebody said, oh, what do we do? The water, and said, no, this is Charanamrita. You have to add some yogurt and serve it out. So people say, this Charanamrita tastes funny, you know. Like it has soap in it. We're just quiet, you know. Anyway, things were done in those days, and we had installed deities. So we had, for years, every year we made a bigger cart. You know, we had a huge cart. 40 feet high, I don't know what, but very, very, very tall cart. And so Prabhupada came in 75 for the Rath Yatra in Philadelphia. He had been there before when he spoke at Swami Nikalananda, before there was a temple, when he spoke at the university at Swami Nikalananda's class, and had given some programs at Temple University. But that was the next time he came to Philadelphia for this parade. And there were lots of deities at that point. Prabhupada was lecturing in the temple room. We had another, we had a building we owned for a temple that had a front porch. And I put speakers on the front porch so devotees could stand in the front porch to hear the lecture, because you couldn't all fit in the temple room. There were so many. I mean, there were Rath Yatra and the porch went, we are down underneath trying to prop it up, you know, so it doesn't crash and fall in completely. Anyway, that's another story. But so then I'd also see Prabhupada when we would have we had meetings about the Bhaktivedanta Institute, and we would also when you come to America, and then by then we were going to Mayapur every year, and with the temple presidents had to go to Mayapur festival with the GBC, and I got time with Prabhupada then. An interesting thing, one last story, this is about where the PhD business comes in. The early Mayapur festival, it's getting to be late at night, everybody's getting ready for bed. I'm in a room with about eight temple presidents, you know, the three-tiered sleeping bunk beds. It was still pretty austere, and somebody comes and says, Prabhupada wants to see you. I thought, what do you want to see me for? You know, because at Mayapur, you know, it was like Prabhupada was always surrounded by a forest of dandas, you know. He was all the sannyasis around him and everything. And we were soon to have a big conflict between the sannyasis in America and the traveling book distribution party versus the household or temple presidents that was to come. So I was probably wanted to see me. I couldn't imagine whatever it was about, especially it was late at night. You know, it was dark and, you know, getting on toward like 9 or something, 9:30, everyone's going to take rest. So I have the gumshoe and I get dressed again and I come running across and up in Prabhupada's room on the second floor of the Lotus building. And I go in his room, and he's nobody's around, it's just Prabhupada and two sannyasis from the Gaudiya Mata. I recognized his godbrothers. I was so puzzled. I offer my obeisances, and I say, yes, Srila Prabhupada. And then he says to me, so what are you writing your doctoral dissertation? So why do you want to know that for? So I had to made me think of a way to explain it. I says, well, Srila Prabhupada, I plan to write about the social, political, economic, psychological, historical, and theological necessity of Krishna consciousness. That's how I put it. That was actually my plan. I had to make it simpler when it came down to it, but that was my plan. And he says, ah, all around necessity. I said, yes, Srila Prabhupada said, very good, thank you. Meaning you can go. I offered my obeisances and went out and said, what was that about? And then people say, what if I want one? I told them, they're all, what's that about? You know, why are you doing this? Nobody knew. And then years later, it occurred to me when I found out that some of Prabhupada's godbrothers were criticizing him, that, oh yeah, he may have gone to the West and made disciples, but they were all drug-addicted hippies. So he goes in there and says, here's a guy, you know, writing a PhD, and that was, I gave him something to, and apparently it didn't occur to anybody that you could be writing a PhD and also be a drug addicted at the same time. So that was one of the encounters I had with Srila Prabhupada where it became useful immediately in that way. Okay, we should stop now. Okay. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Jai.
You're welcome.